examine the principles and process of the evolutionary ascent of consciousness, it is necessary to restate what our theory of integral knowledge affirms as fundamental truths of reality and its manifestation, and what it admits as effectual sides and dynamic aspects, but is unable to accept as sufficient for a total explanation of existence and the universe. For truth of knowledge must base truth of life and determine the aim of life. The evolutionary process itself is the development of a truth of existence concealed here in an original inconscience and brought out from it by an emerging consciousness which rises from gradation to gradation of its self-unfolding until it can manifest in itself the integral reality of things and a total self-knowledge. On the nature of that truth from which it starts and which it has to manifest must depend the course of the evolutionary development, the steps of its process, and their significance. First, we affirm an absolute as the origin and support and secret reality of all things. The absolute reality is indefinable and ineffable by mental thought and mental language. It is self-existent and self-evident to itself. As all absolutes are self-evident, but are mental affirmatives and negatives, whether taken separately or together, cannot limit or define it. But at the same time, there is a spiritual consciousness, a spiritual knowledge, a knowledge by identity which can seize the reality in its fundamental aspects and its manifested powers and figures. All that is comes within this description, and if seen by this knowledge in its own truth or its occult meaning, can be regarded as an expression of reality and itself a reality. This manifested reality is self-existent in these fundamental aspects, for all the basic realities are a bringing out of something that is eternal and inherently true in the absolute. But all that is not fundamental, all that is temporary, is phenomenal, is form and power dependent on the reality it expresses, and is real by that and by its own truth of significance, the truth of what it carries in it, because it is that and not something fortuitous, not baseless, illusory, a vain constructed figure. Even what deforms and disguises as falsehood deforms and disguises truth, evil deforms and disguises good, has a temporal reality as true consequences of the inconscience. But these contrary figures, though real in their own field, are not essential, but only contributory to the manifestation and serve it as a temporal form or power of its movement. The universal, then, is real by virtue of the absolute of which it is a self-manifestation, and all that it contains is real by virtue of the universal to which it gives a form and figure. So, in this chapter, which is related to the aim of life, as we saw in the previous chapter, reality and the integral knowledge, he tries to define what is reality and what is the integral knowledge. And integral knowledge there, he relates to our experience of reality in terms of a sevenfold ignorance and its overcoming in the form of a sevenfold knowledge. And from that, here he is going to develop what is the aim of life and how does that relate to the integral knowledge. So he's reiterating at first what is real, what is the reality, and within it, what is fundamental and what is effectual. That is the first paragraph, as he says there. Before we can arrive at any aim, what is to be reiterated is what are the fundamental truths of the reality and its manifestation, and what it admits as effectual sides and dynamic aspects, but is unable to accept as sufficient for a total explanation of existence and the universe. That is, what is the foundation without which we cannot really come to an effective answer, a true answer of our experience. And as he has brought out in the last chapter, the root, the foundation, is the absolute. It is the root of the form of ignorance that he has called the original ignorance. The loss of that root. And that root is ultimately the indefinability, illimitability of the infinite consciousness. Or what can even not be called consciousness, just reality. So he starts with that as the original fundamental truth. First, we affirm an absolute as the origin and support and secret reality of all things. So this absolute, in its absoluteness, in its singularity, is something that can never be limited by words or by mental language or defined in any way. So it is indefinable and ineffable by mental thought and mental language. But can it be known? It can be known in the way in which it knows itself. And it knows itself by self-evidence, as he says over there. It is self-existent and self-evident to itself. As all absolutes are self-evident, but our mental affirmatives and negatives, whether taken separatively or together, cannot limit or define it. And this is a point that Sri Aurobindo will come to again and again, which is that there is something so absolute, so infinite, that it will never fully know itself in terms of its own contents. In other words, if we think about knowledge as a comprehension, then it knows itself as a self-evident comprehension. Just as we know ourselves without asking ourselves the question whether we know ourselves. But as soon as we ask that question, it is an apprehensive knowledge that we begin to demand of ourselves. That is, can we know that we know ourselves, in other words? Can we define ourselves? Can we articulate what it is that we are, or who it is that we are?
That is the entire field of a knowledge that can be in some way brought into experience and expressed. So this is so absolute that it escapes from all attempts of that kind, but nevertheless it is knowable as a self-evidence, that it's knowable by identity, we may say. We know it because it is us and therefore we are it. Okay. So that is the root. All that is comes within this description. And if seen by this knowledge in its own truth or its occult meaning, can be regarded as an expression of the reality and itself a reality, because everything is arising from it, part of it. Whatever can be experienced, whatever can exist, is derived as a derivative of this absolute. And since this absolute is real, therefore whatever exists must also be real. This is the question of reality that Sri Aurobindo takes his stand on, that irrespective of whether we want to call it imagination, illusion, dream, hallucination, it is real because it is based in something which is ultimately real. This manifested reality is self-existent in these fundamental aspects. For all the basic realities that are bringing out of something that is eternal, inherently true in the absolute. But all that is not fundamental, all that is temporary is phenomenal, is form and power, dependent on the reality it expresses, and is real by that and by its own truth of significance, the truth of what it carries in it, because it is that and not something fortuitous, not baseless, illusory, a vain constructed figure. In other words, in every manifestation, in every expression, in every form, a part, a particle, out of that absolute, we may find the entirety of the absolute that is present. But that internal presence may be experienced by these so-called particles in ways which do not affirm that absolute, as is the case of what is called the avidya, the ignorance. The ignorance is ignorant because first and foremost it suffers from an original ignorance. That original ignorance is the ignorance of the absolute. And so its knowledge or lack of knowledge causes it to have an experience in which its absolute root is lost. And that experience will result in a kind of temporary condition of ignorance. The condition of ignorance is necessarily temporary because within this loss, there is the presence of the absolute. The knowledge of the absolute is present within this ignorance. And so, its temporal existence is a phenomenal existence. It's an existence of a phenomenon, not a permanent or a true existence. And that's why he's saying that everything is real, but within the real, because it is an expression of the real, but within the real, there are those which are expressions by dint of the truth of what they express. What we express, for example, is the absolute in the form of the psychic being. So all else that does not affirm that truth, is not an expression of that truth, is temporary and phenomenal, as he puts it over there. But not unreal, real, but temporary and phenomenal. But these contrary figures, though real in their own field, are not essential, but only contributory to the manifestation and serve it as a temporal form of power of its movement. So we may say that every event that happens in time, every form that exists in space, is present because in some necessary way it is a kind of, you know, sort of unfoldment of that which is true and real, even though those forms and those events may be temporary and in that sense phenomenal, not real in that absolute way. The universal then is real by virtue of the absolute, of which it is a self-manifestation, and all that it contains is real by virtue of the universal, to which it gives a form and figure. So this is the establishment of the reality of the universe and of all the individual existences within the universe by the root of reality, which is the absolute.
So, is he saying that in a way everything that we express, experience is in some way real by way of self-evidence?
He's saying that everything that we experience is in some way real because ultimately it has its root in the real. Its root is real. So whatever emerges from the real cannot but be real. It can false, that which is an illusion cannot emerge from the real. So everything is real. But the question of self-evidence applies primarily to being prior to its emergence as a kind of known form, the form of consciousness within it, which makes it knowable. Self-evidence applies to the whole of Brahma. In other words, it applies to the whole of this, what he is calling the absolute. But within that self-evidence, there is also the field of the knowable. So the knowable is not merely self-evident, but derives its form of knowledge from that which is self-evident. When you're talking, for example, about phenomenal reality, just 1 second, Shyam,
yeah.
Sita, Amita Mehra is trying to get on. Her ID is Amita 6. Mm. Sita, can you hear me? Sita, hello, Sitaram, hello.
Devashish, we'll call him in cell phone and we'll let him know that it's Amita 6.
Okay. Amita, it's okay.
Yes. Amita is A-M-I or double E?
Double E.
Okay.
A-M-E-E-T-A 6.
Okay, we'll tell him.
Does that answer your question, Shah?
Yeah, Shyam is Shyam. He's asking. Yes.
Yes, Debashisda.
Debashisda, one question on the apprehending knowledge.
Yes.
Is that does that assume that we are creating a second person who is the witness?
Yes. The witness or Purusha is a station, or even for that matter, the idea of the Atman or Jiva Atman is an observing station, which is really a replica or replication of Supreme Purusha or Paramatman. That in a sense is Brahman as an observer, Brahman as the enjoyer, Brahman as the knower.
Okay. Shall we read the next paragraph, Debashisda?
Yes.
Shyam, will you read?
Sure. The Absolute manifests itself in two terms, a being and a becoming. The being is the fundamental reality. The becoming is an effectual reality. It is a dynamic power and result, a creative energy and working out of the being, a constantly persistent yet mutable form, process, outcome of its immutable formless essence. All theories that make the becoming sufficient to itself are therefore half-truths, valid for some knowledge of the manifestation acquired by an exclusive concentration upon what they affirm and envisage, but otherwise valid only because the being is not separate from the becoming, but present in it, constituted of it, inherent in its every infinitesimal atom and its boundless expansion and extension. Becoming can only know itself wholly when it knows itself as being. The soul in the becoming arrives at self-knowledge and immortality when it knows the Supreme and Absolute, and possesses the nature of the infinite and eternal. To do that is the supreme aim of existence, for that is the truth of our being and must therefore be the inherent aim, the necessary outcome of our becoming. This truth of our being becomes in the soul a necessity of manifestation, in matter a secret energy, in life an urge and tendency, a desire and a seeking, in mind, a will, aim, endeavor, purpose.
Hello?
Yeah, we can hello, hear you.
Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Hello, Amita, we can hear you. You're in the conference now.
Hi, Amita, this is Lopa. Will you mute your Amita, can you hear? Continue.
Yes.
So what will be good is when you are listening, you can mute your microphone and switch it on only when you need to talk.
Continue. Maybe we should tell her to mute her.
Hello?
Yeah. Yeah, hello?
There's a delay.
Hello?
Hello?
Just a little bit of a pause, waiting for things to.
The Absolute manifests itself in two terms, a being and a becoming. The being is the fundamental reality, the becoming is an effectual reality. It is a dynamic power and result. A creative energy and working out of the being, a constantly persistent yet mutable form, process, outcome of its immutable formless essence. All theories that make the becoming sufficient to itself are therefore half-truths, valid for some knowledge of the manifestation acquired by an exclusive concentration upon what they affirm and envisage, but otherwise valid only because the being is not separate from the becoming, but present in it, constituted of it, inherent in its every infinitesimal atom, and in its boundless expansion and extension. Becoming can only know itself wholly when it knows itself as being. The soul in the becoming arrives at self-knowledge and immortality when it knows the supreme and absolute, and possesses the nature of the infinite and eternal. To do that is the supreme aim of our existence, for that is the truth of our being, and must therefore be the inherent aim, the necessary outcome of our becoming. This truth of our being becomes in the soul a necessity of manifestation, in matter a secret energy, in life an urge and tendency, a desire and a seeking. In mind, a will, aim, endeavor, purpose. To manifest what is from the first occult within, within it is the whole hidden trend of evolutionary nature.
So, you know, here Sri Aurobindo is going back to what he had introduced in that first paragraph, that what is the fundamental truth of the reality and what it admits as effectual sides and dynamic aspects. And we may also bring to mind the previous chapter where he was looking at the various kinds of explanations to reality that have arisen as various philosophies. And one of them, if you remember, he gave a whole number of these views. The first batch of them was subjectivist, and then finally what one might call objectivist. But one of the subjectivist views was that of the becoming being the reality. And we talked about this as particularly various kinds of philosophies that prioritize the existence as we experience it as a energy and a change and something which is constantly changing. So, as he says, this is our normal experience, the experience of phenomenal change, change of phenomena. And if we from that come to the conclusion that this is the reality, the becoming is the reality, then we may also say that we don't need to affirm any being. That is, there is no permanent being that is becoming. And there are several philosophies dealing with that kind of view. We talked last time of some of these, or sometime back of some of these. For example, of Nietzsche's philosophy, or even the philosophy of more modern Western thinkers like Whitehead, who are affirming that there is a principle, either a creative principle or some principle of pure becoming, which doesn't need any kind of permanent being behind it. And Sri Aurobindo responded to that in that previous chapter by saying that if this becoming, even if we say that there is a becoming which is pure in itself and doesn't need a being, if this becoming has created the experience that we have, there is a substantiality to it. In other words, it seems to have inherent in it some kind of substance. And this is not a limited substance because we can't plumb it. There is no end to it. We don't foresee any kind of limit to the creative substance of the becoming. And that in itself is a kind of acknowledgement of a being within the becoming. That's how he points out. And then he says, indeed, being and becoming are inseparable. And to this becoming, we must see a certain kind of permanence that ultimately can even separate itself from the becoming, can have its own status, and reveals itself to be an illimitable being. Now, in this particular case, as he has already established a fundamental and an effectual reality, the fundamental reality for him is the absolute. It is absolute being. So it is something which is illimitable, far beyond any change or any kind of transience. So as he says over there, the becoming is the effectual, the being is the fundamental. The being is the fundamental reality. The becoming is an effectual reality. It is a dynamic power and result, a creative energy and working out of the being, a constantly persistent yet mutable form, process, outcome of its immutable, formless essence. All theories that make the becoming sufficient to itself are therefore half-truths, valid for some knowledge of the manifestation acquired by an exclusive concentration upon what they affirm and envisage, but otherwise valid only because the being is not separate from the becoming, but present in it, constitutive of it, inherent in its every infinitesimal atom and in its boundless expansion and extension. So he points out, therefore, that becoming takes its reality from being. As we know earlier, he established the absolute as the self-evident foundation being is that which the absolute knows itself as. That is, its comprehension, its self-evident comprehension emerges as in its first apprehended form as being. So this being then becomes. And so the becoming rests on the being for its truth. That's why, as he says over here, becoming can only know itself wholly when it knows itself as being. The soul in the becoming arrives at self-knowledge and immortality when it knows the supreme and absolute and possesses the nature of the infinite and eternal. Because those are the primary properties, the self-existent properties of being, since being is the absolute. So this is how he's establishing the aims of life or the aims of becoming. If there is a becoming, it finds its truth in absolute being. And therefore, in seeking that truth in absolute being, it finds its aim. Because without it, becoming does not have a self-sufficient explanation. This is the point that Sri Aurobindo is making here. So once we realize that, once we come to that intuition, once we arrive at that particular grasp, that truth, then the aim becomes very clear to us from the viewpoint of knowledge. To do that is the supreme aim of our existence, for that is the truth of our being and must therefore be the inherent aim, the necessary outcome of our becoming. He's establishing that which is inherent in the becoming. The becoming as a kind of reality, as he says, of exclusive concentration, therefore a reality which is separated, a reality which has its own existence, yet seeking a justification for its existence, seeking a reason or a root for its existence, it must seek for the being from which it arose. Pure being, illimitable being, absolute and supreme, infinite and eternal. So that seeking becomes the intrinsic aim of the becoming. This is the point Sri Aurobindo is making here. This truth of our being becomes in the soul a necessity of manifestation. That's in the soul. Because the soul is that portion of the absolute, which is the basis or the kernel of the becoming. But even in the various stages of the becoming, this is the aim, and it expresses itself in terms of those stages. So in matter, a secret energy. In matter, it is not self-conscious, but still within matter, it is a secret energy which is giving the evolution of forms, the impetus towards the evolution of forms and their ascension in consciousness, so as to house a more and more adaptable consciousness that can fulfill the aim of the becoming. In life, an urge and tendency, a desire and a seeking. So this, in a sense, there is even a blindness to that. This desire and seeking, this urge and tendency. But nevertheless, even if we see it as a will to survive, to devour, to absorb, to eliminate, to persist, yet within this will is a kind of deeper will, a will to the discovery of being. In mind, it emerges even further as the purity of a will. In mind, a will, aim, endeavor, purpose. to manifest what is from the first occult within it is the whole hidden trend of evolutionary nature. So this is how Sri Aurobindo links the becoming to the being to the absolute, and shows the evolution as a necessary outcome of becoming in its rootedness in being and the absolute.
In the triple transformation, Devashishtha, at what stage do we experience the being? Is that completely happening as part of the becoming?
The experience of the being, as you're calling it, the being with the capital B, is something which arises within us as an intuition from the very beginning. That is what impels us towards any kind of transformation or evolution in an individual sense. And so we may say that right from the beginning, the first of the triple transformation, the psychic transformation, is impelled by the seeking for being as the root of the becoming. And it has its experiences even at that very stage. The realization of the being is only in the third stage, because before that, we are realizing representations of the being, projections of the being in the becoming. It is only in the emergence out of the avidya, the ignorance, into the status of supermind that the being is realized. But the being is experienced far before that.
So we would be having glimpses of that as we go. But until the final stage, we are still part of the becoming.
Yes, we are part of the becoming. But we may have experiences of the being. And yet those experiences of the being may not be fully, it may be partial experiences of the being. For example, in Sri Aurobindo's own case, we find that his first major realization was the realization of the Nirvana. The way he expresses this, even in his poem called Nirvana, is not merely that of the unreality of the world, but that of the presence of a permanent something, something permanent. That is an experience of being. It's a partial experience of being, not the integral experience of being. It is only later that he has the integral experience of being. But we find that there is a certain progress that leads him finally to the realization of being. The realization of being as that which possesses being and becoming.
Okay.
Devashishtha, by being, yes. we don't mean the absolute, which is beyond being and non-being. No, what we mean is the Purushottama, or the first, or the Ishvara.
Hello?
Yes. Yes, yes, you're on, Amita. By being, we do not mean the absolute, but we mean the Purushottama. Yes, Purushottama is a kind of, word for the Supreme Person. The Supreme Person. Now, the Supreme Person is, in a sense, the absolute. not in a sense, it is the absolute. The absolute as person, you can see. Parabrahma is supreme, you know, absolute being. But when we talk about being, we are saying that in a sense, the absoluteness, which is beyond being and non-being, unrepresentable, illimitable, has made itself experienceable and knowable. So being as the background of becoming, we are talking about Satchidananda, or we are talking literally about Sat as the root of the Satchidananda.
Otherwise also, once you mentioned it, is this the psychic entity?
Psychic entity is a projection into time and space, into becoming. Psychic entity is the station through which the psychic entity is more like antaratman, as we had discussed earlier. Psychic entity is more like our access in an individualized form to within the becoming, to the being. But it is not the being.
So, Devastha, how would you define experience or the act of experience?
Whose experience?
I mean, the term experience as is used.
Experience, you see, I mean, these terms are all, you know, it's, they're sort of, ultimately they kind of rest on self-evidence. Again, it's, as he's talking about knowledge by identity, they rest on self-evidence. We can try and explain being through experience. We can try and explain experience through consciousness. We can try and explain consciousness through knowledge, or the other way around. But at some point it becomes impossible to define these things. Experience is what is knowable through consciousness, through acts of consciousness.
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Devastha. I'm getting this tendency to kind of metaphysically place this, and as I'm discovering too, it's kind of going in circles.
The question of experience is something which we can talk about in terms of our study or introspection into our own subjective lives. What constitutes our subjectivity? Our subjectivity is constituted by an instrumentality, a subjective instrumentality, and its experiences. Our mind, life, and body are acquiring, are the field of experiences. And these experiences have a certain character to them, but they are basically formations of consciousness or results of consciousness.
Thank you, Devastha.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yes.
Meera, you want to read?
Yes, I can read. Therefore, we accept the truth on which the philosophies of the supracosmic absolute take their stand. Illusionism itself, even if we contest its ultimate conclusions, can still be accepted as the way in which the soul in mind, the mental being, has to see things in a spiritual pragmatic experience when it cuts itself off from the becoming in order to approach and enter into the absolute. But also, since the becoming is real and is inevitable in the very self-power of the infinite and eternal. This too is not a complete philosophy of existence. It is possible for the soul in the becoming to know itself as the being and possess the becoming, to know itself as the infinite in essence, but also as the infinite self-expressed in the finite, the timeless eternal regarding itself and its works in the founding status and the developing motion of time eternity. This realization is the culmination of the becoming. It is the fulfillment of the being in its dynamic reality. This too then must be part of the total truth of things, for it alone gives a full spiritual significance to the universe and justifies the soul in manifestation, an explanation of things that deprives cosmic and individual existence of all significance cannot be the whole explanation or the solution it proposes the sole true issue. Should I continue?
No, I think we'll wait for a, we'll cover this, let's cover this paragraph because he takes another, sort of moves on to another sort of aspect in the next paragraph. This paragraph that you just read actually completes the previous paragraphs. And he's talking here, of course, he talked about the absolute manifesting itself in two terms, a being and a becoming. But basically, he talked about the truth of the becoming as lying in the being. But in any case, what he is still connected with, what he is still trying to affirm, is the absolute. Because the absolute is that which is manifesting primarily as being and secondarily as becoming. That is how he has put it over here. Because the supreme and the absolute are the root which the becoming have to arrive at. In a sense, the becoming have to know the being as the absolute. So over here, as he's pointing out, the philosophies that have given great importance to the absolute as an exclusive reality, as an exclusive experience, have a certain justification. That's the point he makes over here to begin with. Therefore, we accept the truth on which the philosophies of the supracosmic absolute take their stand. Now, philosophies that take their stand on the supracosmic absolute are those that affirm the independent reality of the supracosmic absolute. In other words, we may say that there is something so absolute that within it there can never be the fullness of a self-knowledge that can actually embody itself or manifest itself. That's why we call it the avyakta, that it is in some sense infinitely unmanifest. However much of it may manifest itself, still there is infinity which remains unmanifest. Now, therefore, those who affirm that kind of philosophy have a certain justification. That's the point he's making here. And so, what are the philosophies that affirm that? They are the illusionistic philosophies. Illusionism itself, even if we contest its ultimate conclusions, can still be accepted as the way in which the soul and mind, the mental being, has to see things in a spiritual, pragmatic experience when it cuts itself off from the becoming in order to approach and enter into the absolute. And this is exactly what we were talking about a moment before when I brought to mind Sri Aurobindo's own first realization, that of the Nirvana, which is also like a Brahman Nirvana, a Nirvana in the Brahman, that the Brahman is the sole reality, the permanent reality. And everything in the becoming, which is called phenomenal, is seen as unreal because it has cut itself off from the becoming. But now he turns around and says, but also since the becoming is real, and is inevitable in the very self-power of the infinite and eternal, this too is not a complete philosophy of existence. See, the self-power of the infinite and eternal, the becoming is inevitable, as he puts it over there. It is inevitable because being in its concentration upon itself, in its asking of itself the question, who am I, represents itself, and that representation is the becoming. And that becoming, therefore, is something which is real, a real consequence of an action of consciousness within being. That action of consciousness is also not only real but inevitable, because it is the activity of the power of being. See, whatever is within being as a power of itself can and does become active. And when it becomes active, it by necessity becomes. And so over here, that which affirms this absoluteness of being but loses the becoming cannot but be in some sense not the full truth, be partial in its truth, though it can be experienced as such. Now, how or why can it be experienced as such, as a separateness, is another question which he deals with elsewhere. The very fact that we can take partial aspects of being and affirm them as truths is one of the problems of the exclusive concentration under which we live, under whose regime we live, which is a form of conscious concentration. That is an action of conscious concentration, which is what we call mind or overmind. Now, however, it is the partiality that he's pointing out over here. A realization of being which loses the becoming cannot be a fullness of truth, cannot be a complete philosophy of existence, as he says. It is possible for the soul in the becoming to know itself as the being and possess the becoming. So, truth of being must know itself as that which has become. If it is in full realization of being, and this is what I was saying earlier, it is only in the supermind that we come to the kind of realization which gathers being and becoming into itself as the truth. Possess, know itself as the being and possess the becoming. To know itself as infinite in essence, but also as the infinite self expressed in the finite, the timeless eternal regarding itself and its works in the founding status and the developing motion of time eternity. The becoming is also an eternal becoming. It's the flip side, it's the dynamic side of the being. This realization is the culmination of the becoming. It is the fulfillment of the being in its dynamic reality. Now, this is very important to realize, and this is why Sri Aurobindo is pointing to the necessity of this realization, that not only is this the culmination of the becoming, because the becoming seeks its root in being, but it also is the fulfillment of the being in its dynamic reality. Because indeed, the being has entered into the becoming and has cast the veil of avidya, the veil of the ignorance, upon itself, because it may in its individual instances come to a realization of itself as being and becoming. Being and becoming not merely as one reality that is becoming, but each reality in the becoming as the being and the totality of the being and the totality of the becoming. This self-realization in the each of the one and the all is the fulfillment of the one, is the fulfillment of being in its dynamic reality. That's why, in a sense, becoming seeks for the status But being also seeks for the status or seeks for the realization of this status through becoming or in becoming. This too then must be a part of the total truth of things, for it alone gives us full spiritual significance to the universe and justifies the soul manifestation. This very simple sentence is an extremely loaded sentence if we really ponder it and kind of weigh it in our own souls. An explanation of things that deprives cosmic and individual existence of all significance cannot be the whole explanation or the solution it proposes, the sole true issue. See? Giving the full spiritual significance to the universe. This is a very, very deep, profound point that Sri Aurobindo is making. That is, otherwise, we were fully justified in saying that the divine is indifferent to the becoming. That in some sense, that if the soul absolute was real and the phenomenal was unreal, and we had no need of knowing something that was both the being and the becoming, then the becoming had no real existence or real justification. And as a result, we could even say that the becoming is a whim of the being, or an accident of the being, or an illusion within the being, which are the kinds of solutions that have been proposed. But to say that somehow is to actually completely deprive cosmic and individual existence of all significance. That is not something which gives validity to the reality of the becoming within the being. It's as if the being in some way was impotent, had no control or power over what was occurring within it. And what occurred within it was some accident to which it was completely indifferent, just like a subconscious dream without any law. But as we know now, even subconscious dreams have laws or have certain kinds of forces that can be interpreted. And so, where is that justification? For that justification, we must have a fullness, a completeness of realization which affirms being and becoming, realizes both as aspects of being.
And in some place I read that it's the individual who is the link between the cosmic and the transcendental. Is that right?
Yes, it's actually, as he points out, the transcendental expresses itself in two terms of its being. The first term is the universal or the all, and the second term is the individual or the each. So in a sense, the each is that through whose realization the all and the one, or the transcendental and the universal, are bridged.
So if you try to picture it mathematically, saying that the individual is not a portion but the whole of the all, the whole of that one, it does not appear as an image or something that we can grasp mathematically, right? Because we are dealing with infinities.
Right.
Well, I think possibly the hologram. is our modern symbol of that, although it's not the same.
Round by hologram, you mean a three-dimensional object?
Yes, and mathematically, a hologram, any small fragment of it, when you shine the laser light through it appropriately, will show the whole, although the resolution will be much lower than if you take all of the fragments. But every fragment contains representation of the entire of the entire picture. I'm just speaking of that as a possible mathematical symbol.
Yeah, maybe another symbol could be the fact that every cell in the body has all the genes, but only some genes produce the eyes and some genes produce the leg, but it is the same cell with the same genes. I mean this is for the differentiation part, like, because the same absolute has concentrated itself differently in each individual, but it is the same, it's a replica of that one, just expressing itself differently.
Yes. Actually, Dr. Maheshwari used to give a certain kind of a example, which I remember, that was even simpler, but in some sense, all these are partial representations of that reality. But he used to say that when two people shake hands, it's not the experience of one hand shaking another that we actually have, but it's the contact of two people that we have. So it's really in the part, in the fact that two hands are being shaking, we are actually sort of conscious of the fact that a person is being contacted. The wholeness of the person is present in the hand at that point. So that is the reality of the indivisible unity in all its parts. But here it is a slightly different kind of, a further extension of that, in that if the hand, like, we are conscious of the parts of our being, that is like the all which knows, that's the universal, okay, which the person is, you may say, the transcendental, the sense of being the one. Now, the sense of being the one that has parts to it is a sense of the all that you may say is the universal, right? Now, within that, if the hand had its own consciousness, the faculty by which we know ourselves as a being with parts, let's say the mind, for example, which can give us the sense of reflexivity, is something which carries in itself the sense of the all or the universal. But let's say the hand had its own individual or independent consciousness and had the ability of knowing itself as separated from the sense of being a part of the body or of being the person or a representation of the person. And if it had freedom to think of itself as separate. But now with this freedom, it went back to the kind of knowledge of itself as a part of the whole being, and also as the whole being itself that is making contact with some other whole being, then we'd have that sense of the one which is in the each, which is at the same time a part of the all.
Yes, that is a nice analogy.
Michael has a question, too.
Okay. One of the theses was that the becoming is inherent in the being. But I was wondering, is is it really, could we say something like this particular absolute has a nature that has made this evolutionary plan, and there could have been a different type of absolute who did not want to make this plan of evolution and property and evolution and so forth. And then this would sort of impinge upon the idea that the becoming is inherent in the being. If there was an absolute, I'm saying that it seems to me that the absolute has a nature to do this becoming, part of its nature. And I'm wondering if you would, I think you would comment on that.
Well, when we talk about the becoming as an aspect of the being involved in it, actually he started off by talking about the being as involved in the becoming. But right now, as we came to this particular place where he says, but also since the becoming is real and is inevitable in the very self-power of the infinite and eternal, this too is not a complete philosophy of existence. And that sort of implies what you said, which is that the becoming is inherent in the being. It is inevitable in the being. Now, your question is that a consequence of a specific nature of being?
Of the absolute?
And if the absolute had some other nature, would it be any different? The answer is that the absolute in terms of nature will also have infinite possibilities of nature. Now, becoming is the time dynamism of being. In other words, if there is something which is static called being, but it is illimitable, it is infinite, it can know itself as a project of self-knowledge forever. That possibility is present as one of the infinite possibilities within. That possibility is the becoming. So absoluteness will imply within itself a certain kind of possibility of an eternal self-knowledge. And that would be the time dynamism of being. Time dynamism of being as becoming. Now, whether it is necessary for that becoming to actually have the form that it takes in which we experience it, in other words, a form in which it loses the sense of itself as being, or being becomes involved in it to the degree that we actually lose the sense of the root of the absolute, that can be asked. And perhaps the answer to that is no. That is also one possibility. There may arise other kinds of possibilities of becoming. Becoming which depends on the existence of an ignorance is only one becoming. There may be a becoming in which the being is in possession of the becoming, and being and becoming know themselves as aspects of the same. Of the absolute. So that would be, in fact, the nature of the fulfillment of a being or of a becoming in the ignorance, and the nature of the culmination of a becoming in the ignorance, and the nature of a fulfillment of being in its dynamic a reality.
Devashishda, yes. Another somewhat similar question that I have is related to in the mental consciousness, we experience ourselves in the field of space and time. So are there in the becoming other factors, other similar field space like space and time in other consciousness?
I mean, come again with your question. What kind of other consciousness?
Just like in the mental consciousness, we are aware of two fields in which we experience ourselves, and those two fields are space and time. So similarly, are there other such fields as well?
Other such fields like space and time?
Yes.
Dimensions.
Okay. Space and time as fields of manifestation in the becoming. Becoming sort of rests on space and time, as you said. Now, space and time as fields of becoming are a certain kind of an objectification of being. Being objectifies itself as a extension, as an infinite extension. When we are talking about being as illimitable, then when it represents itself as an infinite extension. That infinite extension is the ground of space. It's an objectification of being as a kind of continent or container. Now, similarly, its subjective experience of its infinity, this is all, both these space and time are arising out of the representation of the infinite nature of the absolute or of being, absolute being, in the becoming. So when this infinity objectifies itself, it becomes an infinite extension, like a container. When it expresses itself subjectively, it becomes like an infinite dynamism that will that will never cease to unfold itself. And that is the basis of space, of time. So both time and space we may think of as aspects of consciousness of the illimitable and absolute. Now, can there be other representations of this same infinity? Can infinity represent itself in other ways? Of course, infinity can represent itself in other ways, and it does. For example, as in intensity, as infinite intensity. Okay, how intense can our experience be? What is the power of experience? Okay. So that also is a certain kind of, you know, experience of measure of the infinite. That would be a field, if you want to call it a field. But the primary fields of the becoming are space and time, because they represent firstly the extent within which the canvas on which this play may proceed, and also the exploration in its dynamism of how this may unfold itself.
Yeah. Devashish, this is Mahesh.
Yes, Mahesh.
I guess this is sort of on the realm of physics, and currently, in quantum physics, it's been almost demonstrable to the theoretical physicists anyway, that there are multiple dimensions, etc. So certainly that exists, even though it's not experiential to us. I guess our experiential dimensions appear to be space and time, but apparently there's a lot more than meets the eye. And that too, just in this sort of terrestrial context, and there might be, you know, numerous other dimensions they would stumble on. So I think they are there, and that space and time are not the only ones, right? I mean,
yeah, but you know, the question is, what are we defining as space and what are we defining as time? So, I mean, you know, on the one hand, you know, even if we talk in Einsteinian terms, you can say, talk about a space-time, right? A space-time in which time can be also sort of, you know, seen as a function of space.
Right.
Or space can be seen as a function of time.
Right.
So similarly, when we are talking about space and time over here in this philosophical sense, dimensionality doesn't really come into play so much as providing a field for the manifestation objectively and subjectively. The objective field for the manifestation is space, however many dimensions it may occupy, and the subjective field for manifestation is time, because in its own subjectivity, it can explore itself forever. See, these become the two major dimensions, and they may have within themselves, in our measurement terms, a number of dimensions. It may even be seen as functions of each other.
Oh, permutations, that's it. Thank you.
So, Debashishtha, you said that time was a subjective experience, whereas space is objective.
Yeah, it's a way of speaking, because there's a place where Sri Aurobindo will say that, you know, to the Brahman, these are interchangeable. But to us, and we can project our own experience and our own understanding to the Brahman and say that space is the objectivity of being, and in the becoming, and time is the subjectivity of being in the becoming. Now, why? Because in a sense, you know, if this infinite being was to lay itself out, was to present itself, like Shiva makes himself the ground of Kali's dance, right? That is space. That is something which extends itself. It opens itself up to the kind of objects and phenomena that will appear in it, right? That is therefore the objective aspect of Brahman. The subjective aspect of Brahman will be the self, you know, sort of reflection. It is turning within to reflect upon itself, you know, what am I in terms not only of the objects that I can bring out of myself, but the kind of experience of what I am, which will be known by me, okay? So that experience is something which is experienced in terms of either a progression or a kind of a movement, a dynamism within the self, which is a kind of, you know, sort of act of consciousness, a dynamic consciousness that we call time.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense in a certain way. Shall we read the next one?
You know, later he will say, I mean, that there's a place where he'll say space is as subjective as time to being, because it's happening within being. Nothing is happening outside of it. It has not sort of become something else to manifest itself. Therefore, space is equally subjective as time. But if we see it as a field that it has projected from itself so as to represent itself, so as to become, that field becomes the kind of experience, objective experience. And the way in which it experiences itself within becomes the kind of, you know, sort of, I mean, the story, when one may say, you know, the history as a his story, you see, which is the experience of time.
So this would depend on the poise one is in, like the reference, point of reference. If we are the Brahman or the being and we see everything inside it, then everything is subjective.
Yes.
But if we are standing as if we are the becoming and we see, we look at the being as something else, then that will look as subjective and the rest will look at object, as if they are objective.
Yes, in a sense. And that status actually is already present in the supermind. This sense of objectivity and subjectivity takes its root in the supermind. Because in a sense, that is where the prajnana projects, as it were, a representation of itself. Without losing the sense of, so it's inside and outside at the same time. It creates the sense of an outside, of an objective reality, while at the same time it is a subjective reality. So that's where there is the kind of hazy ground, the translucency, as he says, at the borders of the overmind.
Mm-hmm.
Luminous double, he uses the term.
The luminous double means where it sees both at the same time, and yet it is not actually both, but it's just one.
Yes, in luminous double in the sense that they're talking about something which is at the same time inside and outside. Subjective and objective.
Yeah, pictorially it reminds me of the Mobius ring. You know that ring which doesn't have an inside and the outside to it? It
yes.
just goes round and round.
So it can definitely seem to be, in a way, a very overwhelming road ahead.
Overwhelming road?
I mean, there's ways to go.
My experience today is that this sort of grouping and the group consciousness itself is sort of a dimension, because I'm sort of transported into like a deja vu of our California sessions, even though we're just thousands of miles away. That itself seems like an experience.
Yes, like a dimension. You're right.
Yeah.
You can see that. You know, the dimension of space as physical space, and the dimension of what we call cyberspace, for example,
right.
Or the dimension of a mental space, a mental universal space. You see,
right.
Kind of what Teilhard de Chardin called a new sphere.
Yes.
Is in a sense the reality of space. One of the realities of space.
Yeah, that being one thing, and that facilitates another reality, which is exclusive to. People who have this common interest, etc., which immediately elevates you gives you a distinctly different situation and comprehension, which is great. So greatly value this.
Yes.
Shall we do one last paragraph?
Yes, let us.
You wanted to read. So Shyam says he wants to read again. Okay, read.
The next affirmation which we put forward is that the fundamental reality of the Absolute is, to our spiritual perception, a divine existence, consciousness and delight of being, which is a supracosmic reality, self-existent, but also the secret truth underlying the whole manifestation. For the fundamental truth of being must necessarily be the fundamental truth of becoming.
Yes.
All is a manifestation of that. For it dwells even in all that seem to be its opposites, and its hidden compulsion on them to disclose it is the cause of evolution. On inconscience, to develop from itself its secret consciousness. On the apparent non-being, to reveal in itself the occult spiritual existence. On the insensible neutrality of matter, to develop a various delight of being which must grow, setting itself free from its minor terms, its contrary dualities of pain and pleasure, into the essential delight of existence, the spiritual ananda.
Perhaps I can ask that one of the elements being put forth is the essential unity, because I think, you know, people alluded to me having multiple absolutes, etc. There is a fundamental unity that is being referred to, and I think that may not have been sort of made explicit.
Yeah, no doubt. Fundamental unity is being sort of you know, expressed, because this is it is the, what he's calling that is the one being, the one, even the absolute in terms of the absolute is known by its oneness. So that is the truth of being, and that is the truth of the becoming. It is one absolute. Because absolute cannot be other than one, and that is the one being, and that is the one becoming. And in it, whatever are its forms are each of them that seem one. So that is the you know, the complete or complex unity of the whole you know, reality, being and becoming.
Yeah. Just as a sort of a clarification of something very fundamental, I guess the term absolute means there is no second, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So I guess that clarifies the idea of built-in unity around.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. Perhaps we can stop over here without going into this paragraph at this point as our last paragraph for this session and return to it again next time.
Sure, Debashish. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Debashish. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good night.
We'll end with a meditation, I think. Will you come to call for it?
Yes, let us end with the meditation now.